It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, you'll hear about the STEAM program put on by the foundation at Hearst Castle.
The first group we had never seen the ocean. You should have seen those kids' eyes. They wanted to jump into the ocean, and they were told not to, but you know how kids are.
Also, we'll visit a local artisan salumiere.
We opened the Alepia about 10 years ago. Me and Antonio Varia, owner of Buona Tavola, were making salami in the restaurant at that time, and people really enjoy it.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 29th. I'm Francisco Martinez. For the last year, art exhibits have been closed around the world, leaving museum spaces empty and art enthusiasts stuck at home. Some venues, like the Harold J. Miosi Art Gallery at Cuesta College, have come up with creative ideas to bring the art to the people. Their virtual reality program is a new way to experience films from home. KCBX's Beth Thornton has more.
VR to Go is a new program from Cuesta's Miosi Art Gallery. Some people have experience with VR, or virtual reality, through video games. In this case, virtual reality delivers a cinematic experience through a headset. Kenghua Liu teaches graphic art and motion design at Cuesta College. He says virtual reality is computer-generated content that fully engages our senses.
One of the key things is it's truly immersive.
For now, VR is primarily used for entertainment purposes, Liu says.
The most common way to use it is like movies, and most of the time is the video games.
Filmed using 3D cameras, Liu says VR movies allow for 360-degree views, so the person watching can see and hear what's happening all around them. In the headset, you can look up, down, and behind you. Four short films are programmed into the headsets available from Miosi Gallery. In one of the movies, you kayak through ice in the Arctic. That's from minus 22.7 degrees Celsius. It's a documentary distributed by Diversion Cinema, especially for VR. The story is about electronic music producer Molecule on a journey through Greenland to record natural sounds for his music compositions.
It's pretty immersive and meditative, and you know, for most of us, I would assume, have never been to the Arctic, so it's cool to be able to experience that.
Emma Saperstein, speaking from the gallery, is the curator and coordinator. She says she wanted to offer something new since the community has been unable to visit the gallery in person.
Just thinking of a way to keep people engaged in an experience that is truly contemporary and truly, you know, outside of what they would do every day.
Saperstein licenses the movies for VR to go. In addition to minus 22.7 degrees Celsius, there's Lalak, set in an oasis in Central Africa, Daughters of Chibok, which tells the story of a girl kidnapped by Boko Haram, and The Real Thing, which explores cities in China that are copies of other cities around the world, such as London, Paris, and Venice. Saperstein suggests that parents watch the films first to decide whether it's okay for their children. She describes the movie selections as short documentaries that deal with real-world issues. Saperstein says the VR films are meant to be experienced at home in a relaxed setting.
The content that we've licensed is designed to be experienced sitting down, so you're not walking around a virtual space. You're just sitting down on your couch or on a chair.
VR2Go headsets do not plug into video game consoles or other technology, and basic instructions are included.
Literally take it home, put the headset on, you should be good to go.
To find out more about VR2Go and reserve a headset, visit the Miosi Art Gallery website. You can pick up and return the headsets on the Cuesta College campus on Mondays or Fridays. Virtual reality is a new way to visit faraway places from your own home. For KCBX Arts Beat, I'm Beth Thornton.
The KCBX Art Beat is made possible by a grant from the Community Foundation of San Luis Obispo County. Working Lunch is a San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce Facebook Live page where we learn about someone in the community doing interesting work. Today, The Chamber's CEO, Jim D'Antona, speaks with Jessica Steele about her experiences in the local green building community.
Welcome to Working Lunch. Today, you'll get to be a part of my conversation with the general manager of Sems & Company Builders, Jessica Steele. Together with other community partners such as Slow Green Build and the California Straw Builders Association, Sems & Company works to raise awareness of green building practices. Jessica, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd love to start from the beginning and maybe tell us a little bit about where you grew up and maybe how you first came to Slow County.
I grew up in a little town called Arnold. It's kind of on a map halfway between Tahoe and Yosemite, so pretty rural. One road in, one road out, lots of snow in the winter. Everybody knows everybody's business. Multi-generations we were there. And yeah, I think that's where I got my appreciation for nature itself and wanting to protect it. When I first came here, it was a little culture shock because, you know, it was a much larger place than where I had come from originally. And yeah, I liked San Luis. I plugged in pretty quickly in regard to the community at large outside of Cal Poly. And I liked how the community really paid a lot of attention to their open space and what a priority that was, balanced with the community and economic development piece. So that's something I noticed pretty early on. And I think really, I mean, I respect that. I respect that intention. So that's one of the reasons I fell in love with the area, of course, and it's gorgeous and the weather's killer.
So tell me a little bit about when you went to Cal Poly, were you interested in your current field of work or did you sign up to do something else?
Yeah, I'd say my path has been relatively linear, which I'm grateful for. I literally do what I went to school for. So I started in, let's say high school, I loved my drafting class. And it was before AutoCAD. We had the old fashioned ammonia-based blueprint machines, which was interesting. I applied to Cal Poly, only applied to that one school. So I got in under architecture. And after about a year and a half, I realized that a better fit in the big picture, organizational, more tangible, kind of a pragmatic black and white, while still being able to be the leader that I want to be with bringing everyone together to achieve a common goal. So I transitioned into construction management and minored in sustainable environments, which was just absolutely perfect for me because I was able to kind of combine all the things I really loved.
After Cal Poly, you came to Sems. What first drew you to the company? And was there like a specific project or an interaction that kind of piqued your interest?
That's a funny story, Jim. Actually, when I was close to graduating, I don't know, maybe two or three quarters before I was officially done, I made a list of the 10 things that I wanted when I graduated. Who do I want to work with? Because it's, you know, we have this paradigm in our mind that who's going to hire me? And instead I really approached it with mentorship from some of my instructors. Who do I want to give my energy toward? How do I want to influence myself in my next step in my career? So I made a list of 10 priorities, and then I sought out an organization that fit almost, actually they ended up fitting all of them. And that was Sems & Co. And I approached them and they weren't hiring. And in some ways I would encourage young people to do that because you end up not having to compete. You just convince the people that you're going to fit in and work out, that your values are aligned, that you're going to really work hard to make it happen. And that's what I did. And really, it was about Sems' values. So there are, you know, at Cal Poly Construction Management, it's an outstanding program. You have a lot of opportunity given to you in whatever field you want to end up pursuing, whether it's civil construction or conventional multifamily homes, whatever it is. And for me, I wanted to work with a company that was going to continue to shift the paradigm, change the ideals. What is next out there? I don't want to just put together sticks and drywall because that's the way it's always been done. I want to continue to innovate. And that was what Sems really brought to the table that I was really excited about.
Well, it seems there's a common theme here. You applied to one school, you got into it. You applied to one company, you got into it. When did you know that, was it back in college? Was it here that you knew that you wanted to lead the company? And how did that transition happen?
So when they hired me, I gave them a 5-year commitment. I said, I will stay for 5 years. That was about 18 years ago. So I started, I was doing project management for our beautiful custom environmentally progressive homes. And the founder, Turco Sims, who really is the ultimate innovator, he brought us all together, ultimately, all of the staff here, we have the same values, and he was ready to retire. So he asked what employees were interested in buying his business. And at the end of the day, it was me and two of my partners, Paul Rose and Tom Moore, and we'd already been working together for 7 years when we actually ended up closing the deal, which was in 2011. And yeah, so it was really kind of at that moment where it was like, of course, I love this organization. It has proven to be incredibly fruitful and nurturing and, you know, having a walk the talk on all the values that I was initially impressed by. So I originally said I'll be your CFO and I want to continue to be project manager. We kept trying to hire salespeople to come in and represent the front end and bring our customers in. But after, I want to say it was 2 years, we were at Michael Gunther's office, Collaborations, and they put me in the hot seat and they said, you just have to take the job. And we also want you to take on the full general management too. And I went home and I definitely had a second glass of wine that night. And I was absolutely outside my comfort zone. And so it was pretty great. I reached out to a lot of resources and I started visiting a life coach, someone that can really help you to make sure you're maintaining that appropriate work-life balance. I took sales classes. I mean, I already knew a lot about construction, so that wasn't really a big deal. You know, I was always a great teammate, but to be the captain was a transition. But now that's been 8 years ago, and I'm pretty comfortable and loving what I'm doing.
You're listening to KCBX, listener-supported public radio. The Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona is speaking with Jessica Steele of Sims & Company Builders.
Is there a particular building technique right now that's trending or techniques your clients are showing an increased interest in?
The history was that we were known as the straw bale builder, and we did a lot of straw bales. In the 17 years I've been here, I've probably done maybe 12. So, and they were really popular when I had first started here. And over the years, we see the demand for that kind of aesthetic is waning because it ends up being a thick wall, a little bit more organic looking because the walls aren't, you know, rigidly straight. They're literally made of straw. But these days we're seeing a great demand around building with earth. So rammed earth is the most common way we've seen that happen. And we've been doing it for decades, and it's kind of novel that it's picking up in popularity right now because it's really fun to do. And orientation, insulation, ventilation, mass. It's that mass piece of this wall that essentially acts as a flywheel to really kind of normalize the extreme temperatures. And again, make it so that you don't need the air conditioning or you need less heat in the winter because you have all this mass that really slowly migrates the temperature one way or the other. So yeah, rammed earth is fun. I would say the other thing that's happening right now that I find quite innovative and novel, again, in that planning phase, is that we're able to take a three-dimensional or a digital model, I should say, which is what we see more now than the old school foam core cutouts. And we've got alternate reality goggles that you put on and we can go to the site and we can put you inside that model at an actual appropriate scale. So you can see what the views are going to be like out your future bedroom window or your kitchen window and really say, oh, well, gosh, you know, let's move it 6 feet over the window or the door so we can capture additional views that we might not otherwise have known to do until we saw the building framed up and there could have been additional challenges with relocating openings and things.
It's interesting to me because it sounds like in your building pieces that talking about that rammed earth, it feels very, again, going back to the Pueblos, like very old school. And yet then you put on alternate reality goggles and figure out how to work. So you've somehow blended old school and new school. That's incredible.
You nailed it. It's that vernacular architectural techniques that were tried and true for centuries, right? Before technology became, it is just like they built of the materials they had and the materials that work most effectively. And so to learn from our ancestors that way for our specific climate area, and then mix in the fancy radiant heated slab and, you know, all electric induction cooktops and things like that. So it's a fun blend. You're right.
Yeah, best of both worlds in that way. Can you tell me a little bit about how you first got involved with community service and leadership in general?
So I first came to San Luis. I was in the red bricks for the architectural college, and I was the Enrich director. So I was on our little student council for the dorms, and my job was to rally all the freshman college kids to go out and plant trees and clean up the beaches and things here in San Luis Obispo. And that was one of the first ways that I was able to connect with our community leaders in other organizations outside of the bubble that is Cal Poly. So many of the students, we just didn't get out of that immediate environment for maybe 2 or 3 years. And then you start to, you know, experience the community outside of Higuera Street. Yeah, so that was the beginning. And then Slow Green Build was an organization that was the first board I was ever chair of. And that was 10 years ago.
Is there one thing you wish people knew about living and building sustainably?
I have a belief that one of my highest values is about personal responsibility. Everything that you do matters. You're the one that's responsible for each and every action. So whether it's little things like recycling or composting, it's all the actions that add up. And you don't have to build a decadent, high-end, cutting-edge, progressive, green custom home to live a sustainable life. My little house is darling and quaint, and we compost and we collect our rainwater and we use our gray water to water our blackberries. And, you know, there's all sorts of things that you can do every day that can feel amazing because you're part of that future. I was joking about my sister, Lauren. She made a comment the other day about what does my 80-year-old self need? And her comment was around 80-year-old self needs 30 or 40-year-old self, whatever your age is, to floss your teeth. And I thought that was the funniest thing. But it's also about protecting our environment and our community. And it's about, yeah, taking those steps each day to be responsible for all of your actions. And sustainability means a little something different to everyone, but to consider it in each decision.
All of us can do something. And all of it counts in the end towards that bigger goal. Jessica, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me, Jim. It is my pleasure.
That was the Slow Chamber's Jim D'Antona speaking with Jessica Steele of Sems & Company Builders. Next, we'll hear from KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer as he visits with Abe Marquez, president of the foundation at Hearst Castle. Marquez shares insights about the foundation's ongoing educational programs that inspire and empower young students from underserved communities.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the Hacienda at Fort Hunter Liggett, and we are here with Abe Marquez, who's the president of the Hearst Castle Foundation. Hi, Abe.
Hello there. How are you? Great to be here. This is a beautiful place.
It is.
Rich with history and how it works.
What's fascinating is the history with Hearst Castle.
Yes.
Here we are 26 miles away from Hearst Castle in a faraway valley, and this was William Randolph Hearst Ranch headquarters.
Yes, it was. Matter of fact, I believe it was in 1927 when Julia Morgan was building Hearst Castle. He gave it to her to commission the Milpitas Ranch here, Hacienda now, for her to go, and they started it. And reinforced concrete, just knew how to build things. And mm-hmm. It was great. I mean, she had 700 buildings to her making that still survive to this day.
Very cool. Let's talk about the Hearst Castle foundation?
The foundation at Hearst Castle. It was the Friends of Hearst Castle. It's been in existence for about 35 years. We are a nonprofit that helps for different projects as far as restoring art, restoring artifacts. There's just so many things that we have done and we plan to do, and we just hope that the time will come where we get a few more memberships, because that does help with finances and having the funds to do those type of projects.
What is the primary mission of the foundation?
Primary mission of the foundation is to support the castle. Like I said before, there's many projects that need to be restored, artwork. We are trying to help with raising money and supporting all these different little projects that the state has there. And we have many up there. It's not an ending series. It's always with one done, there's others. And we have large projects and we have small projects.
A naive question from the outside, why doesn't the state of California take the lead and do the funding? Why is this not untypical of nonprofits to have an adjunct foundation?
Yeah, the state, as you know, now things have changed. They don't have the money. They have their budgets. That's why this foundation, this Friends of Hearst Castle, was started to help support with different projects. I remember back then, the road to the castle was pretty bad, and the foundation helped raise money to fix the roads. And then at one time, the lighting up on the castle, they helped improve it because the state didn't have the money. And granted, they do make money from the castle, from the tours and stuff like that. But right now, of course, with the COVID, we're all shut down. It's pretty tough.
The reason why I wanted to get together with you has to do with an educational program that you've been intimately involved in, which loops in with kids and with STEAM.
Yes, it's our STEAM project that we have there at Hearst Castle, and we are connected with the state parks also on that. And it's called the STEAM program that we have. It's science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. This program that is dear to my heart is that we bring kids in from areas that would never make it there. We had a group from Ivanhoe, which is over in the San Joaquin Valley. These kids were affiliated with a Boys and Girls Club over there. And this is a farming community where there are folks all work in the fields.
Not limited to, but one of your primary targeted groups are underserved kids from rural ag communities.
Yes, rural ag, and also it could be from other areas. We're hoping to get middle-class kids up there to show them the castle and show them the marine life also, because some kids have never seen the ocean, never been to the ocean.
So you take them down Hearst Beach then?
Yeah, we take them down there.
San Simeon.
Yeah, they're at the bay there, and a group from the state will educate them on marine life and give them information. Like I said, the first group we had never seen the ocean. You should have seen those kids' eyes. They wanted to jump into the ocean, and they were told not to, but you know how kids are. We all were that way. We dared it, and they hit that water, and we just laughed. But no, it's a great program. We want to bring kids in to inspire them to think about what they could do. I was one of those kids back then.
So you grew up in an agricultural community,
yes,
right?
Yes, exactly. I grew up in Gonzales, California, which is in the Salinas Valley, and it's an ag community. And both my folks worked in the ag industry. My mom used to work at the sheds there and then out in the field. My dad worked for an irrigation company repairing mainline. So we grew up in that area. And we were just one of those kids that, our folks didn't have time to take us to things like that.
Right, right.
And it was kind of nice because the way I got exposed to Hearst Castle was through high school. Our history teacher took us out and took a group down there. We were like those little kids, just like at awe. Like, what is this place? I mean, wow, it was beautiful. And back then, we got to go and see different things that you can't see now these days and walk through because they found out how priceless it is.
Give us some tangible, hands-on examples of how you loop in STEAM for the kids at the castle.
At the castle, what we do is we bring them up and we do a tour so they go through and see all the artwork. Artwork, tapestries, the Voss's, his collections of books, and give them a little bit of history of how it all started, how Mr. Hearst would entertain people up there. Then they would take them down to the beach and they would show them marine life, educate them on different things that can be done and what it was like back then when Hearst had the pier there and how they brought supplies there. But the kids are just amazed that tour guides will educate them on different things, on the marble, the pools, and we ask the kids. They ask the kids, hey, they ask for questions. And you know how kids are. They have so many questions. And they try to answer them to get them to, you know, think a little bit.
I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Port Hunter, Liggett in Monterey County. Right now, we're at the legendary historic Hacienda, designed by Julia Morgan in 1926 for William Randolph Hearst as his ranch headquarters. We're here with Abe Marquez, the president of the Foundation for Hearst Castle. Can you think of an epiphanous moment that you've witnessed with these kids?
Well, I'll tell you this. Like I said, I was one of those kids, and our first group came in, and there was these two little brothers. Kind of reminded me of my little brother, and we were watching them, and they were just like, I mean, they were scared at first to ask questions, and then finally they started talking. And just to see these kids' faces, to see how they just amazed and enjoy the history of California and the castle, and it kind of brought a tear to my eye. I you know how you get that moment where you choke? Well, that's where I kind of choked, and that's where it reminded me, you know, there's a big world out there, and we need to educate these kids.
STEAM is an acronym, but let's go through what it stands for.
It's science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. With it being 100 years old, with Julia Morgan, we are trying to get these kids to really think about that, especially the girls, because she did it, and it's just amazing what Julia did, not only there, here, and all over. She did the Asilomar there in Pacific Grove, and of course, up in Berkeley, the Cal campus. Phoebe Hearst hired her and did a lot of different buildings there. That's what we're trying to get these kids to open up their mind, because they could be either an engineer, an architect, you know, they could get into science, and who knows? There's just so many things that these kids could wake up and not waste their time.
Right now, we're still hopefully on the tail end of COVID world. The castle is not open for tours at present, correct?
Yes, it's not open at all. Mm-hmm. We're hoping that since everything started opening up, we're hoping that something will happen very soon. Okay. So that we get small tours up there and eventually open the place up so people can enjoy it.
But in the meantime, you've been doing some remote learning programs?
Yes, we do have some remote learning programs with different schools. We've had Wasco. I can't remember exactly how many other schools. We've had a few that it's all remote learning. It's all Zoom, and the kids get to break up in different groups. Mm-hmm. One group will do the down in the bay, and the other group will do the castle, and vice versa. And we send them these kits where they can make cement. One kid made a copy of his hand, and it was kind of cool. You saw that, or they make ashtrays or whatever, and then they give them seaweed beads, and some kids will make jewelry out of them, you know, a necklace or whatever. Mm-hmm. And these kids are just at awe, because right now with COVID, one, they're not at school. Two, it's something for them to do, and they just, you go crazy. We get some great reviews from these kids that send notes to our office, the foundation office, thanking us. And Tara, our development director, she is the one that reaches out to everybody and all these schools and the whole works and sets it up. And you'd be surprised of the acknowledgments that we get, not only from the teachers, but the kids.
And it follows that this is a prime example of where the foundation at Hearst Castle comes in as an economic adjunct to some of these rural small communities the school districts that don't have the funding for field trips, correct?
Exactly. And you'd be surprised because back in our days, which was a few years ago, whenever there was a field trip, we would go for it. And the schools had money to either for transportation, school bus or vans and the whole works. Now these days, they don't have it. I was amazed that some of these school districts aren't set up for it. So what we're doing with the foundation, as far as our STEAM program, is that we're going out and talking to individuals, talking to companies to get sponsorships. I have a lot of connections in the ag industry, and I have gone and approached some companies, and I've been very lucky in getting some major sponsorships. But we are looking, Michael Young is our executive director, and he is out talking to different companies, trying to get some major sponsors to fund this project.
And what would be some examples specific of funding needs?
Well, we need to pay, one, for the transportation, two, for the meal for the kids, and it does cost us for the guides. We need to pay those guides, and it usually takes about 4 or 6 guides to facilitate this program that we have. So it does cost us money, and we're looking for some major sponsorships and stuff like that, which are out there. But right now, with the castle being closed, you'd like to take a group up and sell the project, sell the castle, so where that they come out and they're willing to donate and help us with the STEAM program.
You have corporate funding and underwriting and support, but you also have ma and pa. You also have individual, regular people who might be willing to and motivated to support the foundation. Give us an example of how a normal, regular
I have had some just regular friends that have donated to the castle for the foundation program.
Do you have membership?
Yes, we do have membership.
And how much is that?
The membership, it starts at $500, and it could go up. We have different levels, which, they could go online and see what our different memberships are. And the membership, what it is it helps us with the program, but also with their membership, we do have certain events, and it lets them be first in line to attend dinners.
So back in the day, that happened, and your hope is that, again, before too long, we will have dinner events and in-person foundation events at Hearst Castle.
Yes, exactly. And some of our members that have given on their own have done it in memories of loved ones, which they really enjoyed doing that. They also have asked about different projects if ever something comes up within reason. But we'll take everybody's open to join the foundation.
Looping back to you, how did you first come to be involved with the foundation at Hearst Castle?
Back in 1973, like I said, through high school, my history teacher, Mr. Smith, took a group of kids up and fell in love with it. Every year he would take group up, so we'd all sign up for it and all work. So after high school, college, work, came back up to the castle, and it's amazing. Just fell in love with it. It's in my blood, put it that way. And so what I would do is I bring a group of kids that I mentored through a junior fair board program there in King City, and brought them up, and they just were at awe also. So then a few years later, during the big turn of the century, everybody was saying, things were going to come to a stop and the whole works.
Right.
They had an event up at the castle, and I looked into it, heard about it on the radio and the whole works, looked into it, couldn't make it, then looked into being a member, became a member, and attended a few of the events, which it was great, some of the dinners. We have a deal there called Twilight on the Terrace. It's a wine tasting, beer tasting, all the food you could eat. And if you didn't like it, then, it's your problem. but I just got involved that way. And I asked, how do you become on the board? And a few of the ladies there that were in the office, Sue and Tracy, told me how to do it. Gave me the application and went through an interview, and lo and behold, I became a member.
And what year was that? Roughly.
2014, maybe. And it's been great. I mean, started and worked my way up through the ladder, and now I'm the foundation president.
That's really cool.
It's great.
Yeah, win-win.
Exactly. It's just amazing and hard to believe to be in this position. I just hope that people will consider us, consider joining us.
How would they do that?
You could go online.
And search for
the foundation at Hearst Castle. Go online. We have blogs. We have total information on our foundation. And search farther down, there's how to become a member. And they could click on there and see what levels that they would like to become members. But yes, that would be a great deal for us, because as things have gone, and once the castle gets opened up, I believe we'll have people come back, because we did lose some folks due to the fact of the COVID, just not knowing when we're going to be opened and when be able to do tours and the whole works. It's just amazing sometimes. We get people from all over the place, not only California, but all the way to the East Coast. Sometimes they do come out for some of the, like the Twilight on our Terrace or some of the dinners. They come out because they're in love with the castle like I am.
Yeah. Sign me up.
No problem.
Abe Marquez, president of the foundation at Hearst Castle. Thank you. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from William Randolph Hearst's old hacienda, which is on base at Fort Hunter Liggett in Monterey County, where we've been talking with Abe Marquez, the president of the foundation at Hearst Castle.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio. Artisan salami is rare, and the Central Coast has the only artisan salumiere between San Francisco and San Diego. Alepia has been providing us with delicious salami for 10 years, and on this week's Playing with Food, you'll see how it's done.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. I'm Father Ian Dellinger, and I'm playing with food. We are very lucky to have a salumiere on the Central Coast. I have known about Alepia's products since moving here. What I didn't know is that the artisan salumi is somewhat rare. A quick search revealed that there are artisan salumieres in San Francisco and in Berkeley, one might expect. Then, the others I found were in Petaluma, north of San Francisco, and in Oceanside, down south. So we are very lucky. Central Coast food snobs have been throwing around the term salumi as if they know what it means. So let me clarify what it means. According to California chef Pete Balestrieri, the difference between salumi and salami is salami is one of the many items that fall under the umbrella of salumi, like guanciale, lardo, and prosciutto. All of these items are types of salumi. Salumi is a general term, but salami is a specific type of product. Now that that's cleared up, let me take you on the salumi journey that Alex took me on at his Salumeria in Atascadero. As with many of my journeys, we are on location in a salumi factory, and the noises that come with making great salumi are part of the experience.
So my name is Alex Pellini, and I'm a salami maker. We opened the Alepia about 10 years ago. Exactly 10 years ago, it was 2011. Me and Antonio Varia, owner of Buona Tavola, were making salami in the restaurant at that time, and people really enjoy it. We want to make more so we can sell to stores, some restaurant in the area, and winery, because at that time, actually, winery were not having any food at the tasting room. So we decided to open a small salami plant, and that was the first step. Now we have a bigger facility and store. So we're doing pretty good, and we are happy about our product that is very focused in quality, small batches, and authenticity. Okay. I was born in Italy and lived there for 27 years. Then I moved to London for 1 year, get some experience, learn English, and then I call Antonio, my uncle, and ask him if he had a spot for me at the restaurant, and I start to bartending there. And I still work at the restaurant as assistant manager. I'm from north of Italy, Piemonte. Cured meat is a very important part of the meal up there, before dinner, between lunch and dinner. Anytime. We have a culture of cured meat and good food.
I've been to Italy a couple times, and one time I went to Spoleto, and every time we went for a pre-dinner glass of wine, it came with a plate of salami.
Yes.
We would say, no, we're going to dinner, and they would have,
Oh, yes, that's like a kind of an aperitif part. You know, before dinner, we had this pre-dinner, cold cuts, cheese, and that is what we start our appetite.
Get your stomach going.
Yeah,
get
exactly.
Ready for dinner. And so did you bring your recipes for your salami from Italy?
So we have the base of making salami with the family every winter with my grandfather, Antonio's father. We will slaughter a couple of pigs and make some salami sausages for the family. So we have the base recipe starting from our heritage. And then we add some new flavor, something a little bit more spicy that is coming from southern of Italy. A paprika that we import from that area, Calabria, to make the spicy Calabrese salami. We make the finocchiona, it's a Tuscan style with fennel seeds. And then we have our Parolo, Cacciatorino, and Nostrano that are classic northern Italian salami with not too much spices, but very good flavor. You can taste the wine in it, some cracked pepper. Simple, but good. We have a specialty product particular called Anduja. It's a salami spread. We put salami in a jar, pretty much. It's lightly spicy, it's spreadable. You can serve it for appetizer with bread, or you can make nice pizza with that, serve with burrata, mozzarella. So this spread, we have the idea, of course, from the original Calabrese Anduja, but modified and make it in our way, Alepia style. Alepia is a very important meaning for us. It's coming from my grandmother, first and last name. Her name is Alesina Maria Pia. So Alepia. She passed away in 2011 when then we decided to open the salami plan and thinking about her.
So can I see how you make salami?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yes, I show you the whole process.
Great.
This way.
How fun.
So we're going to the where the magic happened. The production area. All right. This is the production area. Today we're stuffing salami. We use beef casings. It's natural, it's stuffed inside the meat and tied is all by hand using a string that we import from Italy because we cannot find the other thing. Made up of hemp and nylon. It's a thin and is very resistant. They don't make it because here they don't make salami. So this is the meat for the soppressa. Soppressa is a product with a paprika, garlic, lightly spicy, very popular. There hanging we have some finocchiona, fennel seeds and Chianti wine.
These look a lot bigger than what I buy.
Yes. When we stuff the product to the end of the process after 1 month, we lose 50% of the weight.
Wow.
So that is because dry aging process. So the salami are going to two different steps. First, after Thai fermentation, where we drop the pH, reach a higher temperature, the starter culture start to work. And after 2 days, this fermentation process, the salami are being tested for pH and they're moving in the aging rooms.
I thought salami was just dried meat, like a dried sausage, but you're saying there is a culture in there that ferments this?
Yes, it's a starter culture that contains the bacteria that are used to protect the meat during the drying and fermenting process.
If I ground up some meat, put spices in it, put it in a casing and try to dry it, it would kill me.
Yes, it will go rancid, you cannot eat it. Also because you need the right temperature. There is a lot around making salami that people doesn't know.
That's good to know. I will not try to make salami at home.
Yeah, exactly. That's why probably we are the only salami makers between San Diego and San Francisco in the central coast. We're the only one because it's not something that you wake up in the morning and say, let's make salami like you make sausage. Fermenting room, as you can see, the salami are wet. They're gonna have a high humidity during this fermentation process, losing water, and then come out in a couple of days. So we have to go back in the process to start from the beginning. So the meat is coming fresh every week from Iowa and Colorado. We require fresh meat, never frozen. It's not easy to get it, but we have a truck coming every Friday. So the next week, we use it in about 4 or 5 days. Like they do in Italy, our grandparents. So that is a flavor profile that will come out when you taste the product.
Why don't you get your meat from California?
Because there is not a plant that can guarantee us the freshness. They will send it to us frozen. We need to require that hormone-free natural meat. And we even find that it is too small for what we need, the amount weight that we need.
So you fall in between the small producers and the large corporate cattle and pig production in California.
Exactly. After we receive the meat, we trim the meat, taking it off the nerves, the blood clot, clean the meat best as possible, get ready to the grind. And then after grind, the meat is going to the mixer where we mix with the ingredients, flavor, wine, garlic, and we let it sit in a walk-in refrigerator overnight. The day after, we stuff and tie the salami. The tying process is very important. You learn how to tie a salami after 6 months of training because there is a lot of manuality, a lot of feeling. The casing are natural, so easy to break, but you don't want to leave the salami too soft because air can go in. This is the art that it trespassed from our grandfathers to us, and we give it to our employee. You need to have experience, very much experience, to make a good salami.
This is KCPX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Father Ian, learning lots about salami with Alex in Atascadero. As we moved on to the next stage, the background noise got a lot quieter, and the process of making salami became much more evident that it's not simply drying out a sausage.
You use a beef casing. Is that for both pork salami and beef salami?
We don't make beef salami. We just make pork salami.
Okay.
The only beef is the casing. It's a classic Northern Italian to make pork salami.
So now they're in their casing, they're hung. What next?
The salami, at the end of the day, will be all go inside the fermentation for 2 days. After that 2 days, we test the pH, when is the right pH that USDA require. We move it to dry aging rooms. So this is our packaging and aging room area. Aging rooms are imported from Italy as well. They have a big engine on the back that control humidity and temperature. So we reproduce the basement that we were used in Italy when we were making salami. So that temperature, that humidity that make the mold growing on the salami, because mold is a very important part of the salami as well. So we go room number 3, where we start. Yes, 52 Fahrenheit. These beautiful rooms with our salami that are start to losing weight, start to dry. You can see mold is growing, and that is good. Some nice white mold for flavor profile.
I've always wondered about the white stuff. Tell me more about the mold, because I didn't actually know that it was mold.
Mold is growing naturally on the product with the humidity. If you go in Italy and you go to an artisanal deli or a salami maker, you see salami with mold. It's normal. Actually, you can eat it. You know, you can slice. You don't have to peel it. I peel it, you know, just to taste the meat. But a lot of people, they want to have that profile and the casing is natural. You can eat it. I most of the time peel it, yeah. We keep it in the first aging room for 10 days, about 7 to 10. Then we move it in the second room where they stay up to 20 days until they are ready to come out.
Why do you have to move it to a different room?
Because when I go in here, more wet, the humidity is high there. Then we move it to a room that is going slower, just to keep the product aging little by little and the product are more dry. And then after these 20 days, we test the water activity. So the content of water is good to go for USDA regulation and taste it ourselves, make sure that are the way we want it, and go to packaging, yes. I show you another beautiful room here, guanciale, pancette, the whole muscle room.
Wow.
So we have a coppa, that is pork shoulder cure, like prosciutto. We have a pancetta, it's a cured pork belly. And we have guanciale. Guanciale is a pork jaw. We started to make it about 2-3 years ago. People were thinking, we were crazy. Why we do jaw? Nobody eat it. Now is the product that we sell more than everything else, even more than salami.
It was really interesting. I was watching a TV show that used that, and I was like, I'm never gonna find that on the Central Coast. The next day, I was in the grocery store, and I looked down, and there it was. I was like, oh my gosh, I can make this recipe that I thought was with this
ingredient that you probably wouldn't even be able to find in the U.S.
Right, so what do you find out that day? A lot of people find out as well, because we start to get online order for this product, and, you know, in general, even pancetta, because you can substitute pancetta with guanciale, but the classic amatriciano carbonara pasta in Rome, for example, is made with guanciale. So chef discovered that, and they call us from New Jersey, from New York, San Francisco. They all want our guanciale.
You talk about testing. You have to test it in the fermentation room for the pH, and then you have to test it for its water content in this room.
Yes.
In a typical batch of, say, your regular retail salami, like the Barolo, how many go to waste because of testing?
There are not, actually, because I know that after that amount of days, that can be 20 to 28, the product reaches the right water activity content. Plus, if it's happened, you know, happened before that I slice one is a little bit above, at that point, the product is ready to eat, at least for me, maybe not for USDA, but in Italy we eat salami that are much more softer than you find salami here. So for me, are good anytime to eat, so that one, I keep and slice it and eat it. What I do, I go in and touch it, see the consistent feeling, and I know when it's ready.
It's not all about instruments, it's about...
No, the instruments are just actually for show and check, but the feeling and the experience is what we base on a lot.
This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio, and you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Father Ian with Alex Pellini, who makes artisan salumi in Atascadero.
So it comes out of here, it goes to packaging. Where do you do your packaging?
Packaging right here. David is packaging right now some of our pre-sliced product. We send it to a company that pair our salami with wine, and they do shipment. It's like a club. They like our product to pair with their wine. We do this program also for wineries around here, because it's easy for people to grab the package and already slice.
So is that the end of the process then? Have I seen everything?
Yes, you can see we use wine for the product. We have some nice Chianti for the Finocchiona and our Cacciatorino salami. We infuse with garlic and then let it sit for a few hours and then strain with a cheesecloth in the meat, so the garlic doesn't go directly, but the flavor in the wine. We have on David Zinfandel for the Soppressa. We have Nebbiolo, that is the grapes that you make Barolo with, from Lange, for our Barolo salami. Okay. Very good wines.
Okay. It was time for the big request. Then some additional information as we went back to the store.
Can I taste some salami?
Yes, of course. Yeah, we don't do tasting right now, but for you, I will. We get this, we go back to the party.
Okay.
You wanna...
I'll carry that for you.
Yeah, thank you. There you are.
So you import a lot of your ingredients?
Yes, actually, the spices are local.
Okay.
Local, we use local spices are from here, no imported. Just the paprika, that one is coming from there because the flavor are very unique. The truffle that we use in salame tartufo are from France, the black truffle, and the white truffle extract is from Alba, Italy.
Then came the best part, the tasting.
I haven't tried truffle. I'm not a big fan of mushrooms, but I'm willing to try it. And I've never seen the Nostrano.
Nostrano is amazing. My favorite. So, tartufo and Nostrano. Did you try the Anduja?
I have not.
You like spicy, right?
Because I do.
I like it. It's very nice. It's an spreadable, you know.
How do you pronounce it?
Anduja.
So I'm going to go home and play with this and see what
fun
stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You know, put it on bread. If you have some mozzarella, it's nice with that. It's a great product, like carnivore peanut butter.
Carnivore peanut butter.
So we don't change our way because customer want that. We want that the customer go to Italy, come back here, and find the same experience.
Mm.
Very fresh. He has a pork ham. For all the other salami, we use the shoulder. This salami ham, so the part of the prosciutto. So you see the color is clear. If you cut a Barolo, it's more dark. Also because the wine, but the meat is more clear, more delicate. Like when you slice prosciutto di Parma, you know, that delicatess.
Right.
White wine, okay. Cracked pepper. So, you know, simple, but that's what in north of Italy do. Simple ingredient salami, good quality.
Can I try one with the casing on?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so this is the casing, yeah. It has the mold.
And actually, I like that. Yeah. You know, it reminds me even more Italy now that I tasted with you in Italy when I was a kid, probably because I was just eating with the skin.
It's really nice.
It's nice.
It is really nice.
You know that you have a strange flavor. Accomplished the meeting. Tartufo. beef casing, but different size. The tartufo, we don't want to have a big salami tartufo because the flavors are so intense that you don't want to be a big bite. So usually, even in Italy, a salami, little salami with truffle.
It's nice. It's not overwhelming because, like I said, I'm not a fan of mushrooms.
What we do with our salami is exactly that. We balance very well.
It's really nice.
Yeah.
This slice just reminds me of sitting on the porch of a winery in summer.
Right.
Which, of course, none of us have done for a year.
Yeah. Some wine outside with nice weather, cheese and salami.
Yeah.
Beautiful. I took the salumi from Alex and did some playing with food of my own. I made a pizza that was tartufo on one side and andouille on the other. I made andouille at deviled eggs and what I called California andouille shishuka. And I, of course, had several lunch plates with salami, cheese, and fresh vegetables. It was all blissful. Food is not just for fueling the body, and producing food is not just about making a living. Food, for me anyway, has much deeper meanings. And for Alex as well.
There's something deeper that is motivating you to do this.
No, for sure it's family, business, we like to success and doing a good job all together. You know, we came here in the United States for that, to do better and have a good life, a nice life, a happy family, and stay together. So that's what we do. We want to eat a good salami ourselves before sell a product, you know. We want to make sure we taste it, it's great. And now I think we reach a very, very, very good product, and we're so happy about it. And the name, you know, is related to grandma, so that's very special. Yeah, it's more than just a business, for sure. Yeah. Having salami and cheese is the easiest thing, and for us, it's a part of our life, and now it's become part of life of our customer.
Food is a combination of love and magic, isn't it?
Yes, yes, exactly. Passion. The first person I give a salami is my daughter, and I want to give her a good product, of course, the best product, the most health, the best quality. So that's what we do. That's what we do.
When you want what's best for your loved ones, it's more than just a business. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Francisco Martinez. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or listen to past segments. It's all at kcbx.org.